take your meds, kids. Elementary school students taking drugs every day, not a problem. Pediatricians add obesity to a growing list of chronic childhood health problems and recommend cholesterol screening and possible Lipitor for the little ones. Should the school nurse have a school pharmacist? Your kids on drugs. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 7th, and we look at a new call from pediatricians to combat the effects of childhood obesity. Also, bringing Bounty to the Barrios, an innovative program to get fresh produce in the hands of inner-city families. Growing vegetables on Mars? The temperature, well, it's not a problem. The soil is. Or I should say, the temperature is a problem. The soil is not.
Freezing.
FEMA trailers creating, not solving, problems for some hurricane-devastated neighborhoods. We get an update on that. And a Wimbledon for the ages. Nadal slays the giant on grass. Did you catch it? That and all the news. The annual summit of the world's leading industrialized countries, the G8, is underway in Japan. First up, aid to Africa, though rising oil and food price discussions are likely to dominate. The Japanese government had hoped climate change would lead the agenda. Spokesperson Tamahiko Taniguchi predicts climate talks will be tough.
This is probably going to be the most important and complicated negotiation process that humankind has ever experienced. There has got to be a tremendous peer pressure among the G8 leaders.
President Bush is casting doubt on a climate accord. He says China and India would also have to agree to cut pollution. In Kabul, Afghanistan, a large explosion has killed at least 40 people, wounding more than 140. Government officials say a suicide bomber rammed a car filled with explosives into the gates of the Indian embassy. They suspect Taliban militants.
Iraq is receiving a diplomatic and financial boost. The United Arab Emirates is restoring full diplomatic ties and forgiving $7 billion in debt. As we mentioned, the American Academy of Pediatrics is now recommending aggressive cholesterol screening for children as young as 2 and prescribing cholesterol-lowering drugs as early as 8 to help them avoid future heart problems. The new guidelines are being issued today based on mounting evidence showing damage leading to heart disease begins early in life. More coming up.
It was a dramatic day at Wimbledon. Did you catch that, John?
Oh, yeah.
As Rafael Nadal has won, or did win, his first title at Wimbledon, dethroning five-time champion Roger Federer. The match was one of the longest and most dramatic in the tournament's history. Nadal says it was a day he longed for his whole life.
When I was a kid, I dreamed for play here, but for win is amazing.
He is only the second man ever to win the French Open and Wimbledon back-to-back. The candidates are back on the trail today. John McCain in Denver and Barack Obama in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Oil just below $144 a barrel. The S&P begins trading on Wall Street at 1262. We want your views on medication and diet. We're going to be talking about those issues today. And we want to know if diet and medication is more important for kids at risk of childhood obesity. What would you recommend? Also, what was the word of the week in politics? Can you guess? We'll give you a chance. And would you like to become a gardener on Mars?
I do.
Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Bring your shovel and join Adora. Up there on Mars, near the poles. You better bring a sweater, though. You need a sweater.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin today with the G8 summit of world leaders of the 8 richest countries just underway in Japan today. And who can forget, thinking back over the last 8 years, all the great G8 summit moments for President George W. Bush. There was the Merkel hug. There was getting to know Vladimir Putin well enough to call him Pootie.
Who could forget that?
Oh, yes. An era is ending as George W. Bush is at his last group of 8 or G8 summit. It's being held at a remote mountaintop resort in Japan. The leaders from the U.S., Japan, Britain, Germany, France, France, Italy, Canada, and Russia are in attendance. But the Bush goodbye and all the head of state handshakes are hardly the headline today. In the grips of global inflation, the eight richest nations are getting better acquainted with five growing economic dynamos who represent nearly 3 billion people and someday just might hold the center of mass in the global economy as well. Joining us from the press center in Hokkaido, Japan, is Bridget Kendall, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Bridget, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
What do you make of this G8 versus the G5? The discussions that are going on certainly have to do with the G8's agenda, but there's also this growing concern of these five other economic dynamos, China, Brazil, South Africa, Mexico, and how is that figuring into this summit?
Well, that's right. And in fact, it's not just the G5, but today they've also been giving outreach to seven African leaders, because the discussions that have been going on today are about poverty and aid in Africa. And those hikes in gas prices and food prices, which have hit the world's poorest, and Africa above all. So it's not just thinking about all the other big, powerful economies that make up the global economy that the G8 leaders these days have to think about. It's all the have-nots who don't have what the rich nations have, but in order to ensure that there is stability and prosperity and that the world works in an even way, these days, every year, G8 leaders spend as much time thinking about poverty as they do thinking about their own rich economies.
Well, Bridget, with these kinds of issues on the agenda, poverty and, of course, climate change and questions of politics in Zimbabwe, is it the case that a G8 summit is somewhat obsolete because the nations that are talking about these issues are not the nations that represent the billions of people who are most affected by some of these problems?
Well, you know, that's a very good point. It's not a bad year to remember why the G8, well, it used to be the G7, was created. It was after the OPEC oil crisis in the 1970s, when these rich nations, mostly consumers of oil, wanted to get together to coordinate their policies economically worldwide. Well, here we have another oil crisis this year with high price rises, but they can't sort it out on their own. They need everyone else to be on board as well. And that's where you get the problem, because it was hard enough to get agreement when you just had seven countries. But when you've got these other big giants, particularly China and India, coming along, it's much harder to get agreement. And it's going to be Wednesday when they focus particularly on climate change. But we can already see that there's a kind of divide. There are the big industrialized economies that for years have been using a lot of energy. The United States, of course, the biggest gas guzzler of them all. And then on the other side, you have the new emerging economies like China and India. And their argument is, look, we don't think there should be an even playing field with us. We're just beginning here. We need to keep emerging and we need to keep using energy. So it's not right for you to penalize us with the same rules as you. But what everyone else is saying here is, along has come George Bush for his last G8 summit. And on arriving, he said, look, if we're going to do a deal on climate change, it has to sign out everyone, including India and China. Otherwise, the U.S. won't be there.
Is there something strategic or tactical in what George Bush is saying, trying to use China and India as a kind of climate change alliance so the U.S. doesn't feel so isolated? Certainly, George Bush rejecting the Kyoto protocols was viewed as an isolated industrial leader.
Well, there are different views on that. One is that the U.S. president just wants to kick off these commitments into the long grass, into the far future, so he doesn't need to sign up to anything right now, so that this won't squeeze the U.S. economy even more at a time of economic troubles. And he's probably not the only industrialized leader who thinks that way. There's a lot of worry among the lobbyists here that no one's really in the mood to squeeze their economy more, either to give up aid for the poor or to tighten their belts over energy. And that's one of the big problems this year. But there's another problem with George Bush, and that is this is his last G8 summit. And he's already what many people call a lame duck president. And you can kind of sense that. The Russian officials, for example, ahead of President Medvedev's meeting he had with George Bush earlier today, said he was going to take a very tough line, a very critical line with the U.S. president. He can afford to be tough with him. He's
sure
not going to be around that much longer. Well, and the same thing with climate change. Why should China and India sign up when this U.S. president won't be there? And who knows what U.S. policy will be next year?
Well, certainly the Bush goodbye is one theme. The issue of Zimbabwe will come up, and there will be more discussions of climate change later on in the week. Bridget Kendall, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Bridget Kendall, BBC diplomatic correspondent, reporting from Hokkaido, Japan.
Fascinating point that they spend as much time talking about poverty as they do about economic prosperity in the leading developing nations. Big news today is coming out of the American Academy of Pediatrics. It is sure to spark a lively debate. They have released the strongest guidelines ever to treat children with cholesterol problems in an effort to ward off future heart disease. About one-third of American children are considered overweight, nearly 20% obese. For the first time, the Academy is recommending screening begin as young as 2 years old, and that children as young as 8 might need cholesterol-fighting drugs. Peter Jung is a pediatrician in Houston, Texas, as well as a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Good morning, Dr. Jung.
Hi, good morning.
Widespread screening and potentially prescribing cholesterol drugs, do you think that's a good idea for children?
Well, I'm a little bit skeptical right off the bat about this, and mostly because even in adults, there is a little bit of skepticism about the use of cholesterol medications. Namely, people are wondering, do all the people who are healthy, who have never had heart disease before, who don't have family histories of heart disease, who have a slightly elevated cholesterol above the line that they use right now, which is 200, or if your LDL is above, which is low-density lipoproteins, which is a very specific type of cholesterol.
A bad, they call it the bad cholesterol.
Right, they call the LDL bad cholesterol. High-density lipoprotein is considered the good cholesterol. And when your LDL is above 100 or total cholesterol is above 200, there is some recommendation for adults even to use cholesterol medication, cholesterol-lowering medication. Specifically, the biggest one is called statins. And it happens to be also the biggest category of drugs in terms of money-making worldwide. And so these are powerful drugs, not just in terms of our health, but also in terms of our economics. And in the adult world, there is not definitive proof that using these medications will reduce your heart disease and prospects in the future or lengthen your life.
And because of that, you sound a little suspicious, noting that it's a big business, some of these drugs. On the other hand, an Academy nutritionist is quoted as saying, children are facing an epidemic in this country.
Absolutely. And I don't want to I want to clarify myself and say that statins and cholesterol-reducing drugs are definitely helpful for certain people. If you've had heart disease before and you have a heavy history of heart problems in your family, there's no question that cholesterol medication can help adults and maybe even children and in certain types of categories. And especially if your family has something like a familial hypercholesterolemia where your family has a genetic disorder where you happen to have a high level of cholesterol running maybe in the upwards of 500, 600, cholesterol medications are necessary, not just for the adult, but also for the child. But when we're talking about the child who is slightly overweight and may have a slight high level of cholesterol, I don't know that we as a nation want to be jumping to the cholesterol-lowering medications.
Do you think that goes to the criticism that sometimes Americans come up with a pill to solve everything?
It certainly feels like that sometimes. And that adds to the whole skepticism of using these medications. Really, the big thing about these types of medications is that, and I don't know if you are aware of this, but there was a little bit of an outcry back
in 2000. But before you take us down that route, because we just have a bit of time left, there really is a problem. What do you think needs to be done to address these cholesterol and weight issues that so many children are facing in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, your typical recommendations are still true today that your mother always taught you, which is eat right and exercise more and get out of the house, reduce your screen time, don't stay in front of the TV and the computer all the time. And in terms of eating right, restrict your saturated fats, restrict your cholesterol.
But you think the jury is still out as to whether or not drugs should be thrown into that mix, right?
That's correct.
Dr. There's Peter Jung, I'm going to have to leave it there. Thank you. Dr. Peter Jung, pediatrician at Memorial City Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston, Texas. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've teed up a hot button for a lot of parents on the issue of drugs and kids. What's more important to combat childhood obesity, diet or drug therapy? Here's a comment. I'm split on the issue of drugs for kids. I'm very worried about overuse of drugs and think it's a serious issue for kids and adults both. On the other hand, I have three kids with different types of mental health issues. Medications have helped, along with therapy and training. One kid could possibly benefit from weight loss medication, but for now, we're just working on diet and exercise. Thanks so much. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can reach us.
A real dilemma. Mm-hmm. Also a real dilemma for many people living in inner city neighborhoods, getting their hands on or having access to some good food. But in Tamika Finn's Philadelphia neighborhood, there's something new, a grocery store.
We have McDonald's here, McDonald's there, McDonald's everywhere else. Especially people like myself, I like to eat better and healthier every day. Fast food isn't always good, so it's good.
It's good, the new grocery store that's been in her neighborhood for 6 weeks, and that means affordable and nutritious food in her Philadelphia neighborhood, where, like thousands of other inner-city communities, has been scarce for decades. Very few grocery stores. They call it the grocery gap. Grocery stores fled city neighborhoods all over the country in the 60s as whites moved to the suburbs, and they haven't been back. Pennsylvania State Representative Dwight Evans, well, he's begun a solution. His Fresh Food Finance Initiative is making big changes there in Philadelphia. Welcome, Representative Evans.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you, too.
You say it's a simple plan you have.
Yes, it is. Basically, the idea is to put supermarkets in underserved areas. And what I basically do is use the incentive of state government as a way to attract these supermarkets. They do a couple of things. First and foremost, they deal with the element of obesity by giving quality fresh vegetables and foods available to the neighborhood, not give in terms of people buying. The element of jobs, economic development it creates, but it also helps transform the community. As a kid growing up, obviously supermarkets are very much a part of a neighborhood. A lot of people sometimes take that for granted because they have them in their particular communities, but a lot of the inner city neighborhoods and the rural communities don't necessarily have access to these quality types of supermarkets available to them.
So the big public policy problem here is lack of access to good food fuels poor health,
correct,
hypertension, things like hypertension, heart disease,
correct,
obesity,
correct,
and so on. This has been an intractable disconnect for a long time, not having grocery stores in some underserved neighborhoods. What has been the resistance from the grocery stores to go into those neighborhoods?
Well, basically, a lot of times it is the question is, can they make money, first and foremost? Secondly, would people take advantage of it? What I found out is using a public-private partnership in terms of incentives. We so far in the last 3 years in Pennsylvania have generated about 50 supermarkets across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, about 20 of them in the city of Philadelphia, and about 30 across the rest of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is an agricultural state, so it makes a direct connection to the aspect of food farming, food processing, all of those kinds of things available. So only thing that the state has done is we have made $30 million available in the last 3 years, total $30 million, formed an alliance with something which you call the new tax market credit program, which is a federal initiative. We've put those two things together. And through that combination, the key thing I want you to understand when you raise the question about the resistance from the operators is you got to use a form of an incentive to basically draw these supermarkets to these particular communities.
So $50 million, 52 projects, and you've generated over 3,000 jobs.
Yes, correct. Correct. And as a result, this program has now been recognized. Harvard has recognized it in the last year as one of the top 50 state programs that is creative and innovative.
And congratulations for that. That's really great progress. But I'm wondering, Representative Evans, how much work needs to be done to give families in these neighborhoods better access to kitchens and better sort of time access to be able to prepare a lot of the foods in here. Sometimes part of the reasons why the bodegas and the fast food have been so effective in these neighborhoods is that they can effectively market convenience over the qualities of health in preparing your own food.
Look, you raise a good point, John. There's no question that we're talking about a lifestyle change. But in order to talk about lifestyle change, you have to talk about food access. If you don't have the food access, it's a mindset. And the reality of it is we have not had the food access from what you just described in these various communities and neighborhoods. We have not had it available to people. And I think that government, from a national level to a state level, can look at it. If we want to talk about changing our health system, we have to change the mindset and talk about having an approach more from a wellness approach before we get to the doctor. I mean, the reality of it is you get checked up at the doctor, but that should be after the fact. You got to change from exercise. You yourself said that. You got to change from terms of having food available. Those kinds of things change a mindset. You cannot wait until all of a sudden, you know, you discover some problems and then you go to the doctor.
Is that the lesson you believe that you can share with other communities who face these exact kinds of obstacles?
No question about it. I think, again, you know, healthcare is a major issue on our national debate. And the reality of it, you do have to talk about the aspect on the front end from a prevention standpoint, and having quality supermarkets available, in my view, is a part of that solution. So we're talking about dealing with the mindset, but you mm-hmm. have to have the availability of quality foods available.
And you're making that happen in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania State Representative Dwight Evans, thank you.
Thank you.
He is the man who developed the Fresh Food Finance Initiative in Pennsylvania. Now we have headlines from Femi Okay. Femi?
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. A senior Afghan police official says the death toll from a suicide car bomb attack on the Indian embassy in the Afghan capital today has reached 41. The massive bomb knocked down a wall and damaged two embassy vehicles when it exploded at the embassy entrance. The G8 summit is underway today in Japan. President George Bush says he will hold fellow worlds accountable for various pledges of aid made to Africa. Sue Imbaya of the children's charity World Vision says a pledge made at the 2005 G8 meeting to double aid for Africa is falling short.
Women, children and men in Africa, many of them continue to have substandard levels of existence, and they continue to die because these promises have not been lived up to.
Under current spending plans, the G8 will only reach $10 billion of the proposed $50 billion in aid, half of which would go to Africa. Presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama will duel over the economy this week. McCain will be in Colorado today discussing proposals he says will stimulate job growth, and Barack Obama will be in North Carolina discussing economic security for families. McCain is expected to offer detailed plans outlining how he would balance the federal budget sometime this week.
And firefighters have been lucky in the West, but that's going to change because the weather, I guess, is going to be going against them.
Temps up to the 90s again by midweek.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Some supermarket suspicion and an almost immediate response on 877-8-MY-TAKE to the conversation a moment ago about bringing supermarkets into the inner city. John on our website says, there is no such thing as quality fresh fruits and vegetables in any market, let alone inner city. There are merely tasteless items shipped thousands of miles that look like fresh fruits and vegetables. If you want fresh fruits and vegetables, go to a local farmer. Hey, that's really local. That's then maybe the next step after supermarkets. We'll get farms in the inner city. There used to be, actually.
I think we'll make that a segment someday so we can talk about that. In the meanwhile, we're going to go to New Orleans, where nearly 5,000 people are still living in trailers. This is despite the deadline for most to move out by July 1st. City officials say they're just trying to get things back to normal, and they're threatening $500 a day fines for those who don't move, don't get an exception or an extension. But advocates say the entire system is mired in bureaucratic red tape, making a nearly unbearable situation much worse. Dr. Edward Blakely, Executive Director for Recovery Management for the City of New Orleans, joins us now, as does Lauren Bartlett, a staff attorney for the Louisiana Justice Institute, a civil rights advocacy group. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Dr. Blakely. Nearly 5,000 people are still in trailers. Have you started levying fines yet?
No, we won't do that for some time.
Explain how some are exempt, some are can get extensions, and that roughly several hundred people out of those 5,000 have already gone through that process.
Well, the way it works is we're trying to get people's attention that they should be moving out of their trailers and taking steps to do so because we're in hurricane season. So what we've done is we've gone around and put a tag on every trailer saying you're supposed to move out, you're in violation of the city's ordinance with respect to having a trailer on your property. Please notify us as to when you plan to do so. If you don't notify us, you're subject to a fine.
And is that something that's very simple, Lauren, to notify those in charge that you need some kind of time before you can move?
Well, the city has put out a form that folks can fill out and submit with other sorts of documentation to request an appeal, for an extension in their trailers. The problem has been people understanding that, actually the city has been granting a lot of those extensions, but the problem has been getting folks, to submit those forms, know where to submit them, know what kind of documentation is needed.
And Lauren, you've said you don't think that the city is actually doing enough.
No, the thing is that, actually having this July 1st deadline and then, talking about imposing fines is adding to the stress level of folks whose stress level is already through the roof and has been for the last almost 3 years. In early June, we had a gentleman who had an altercation with his FEMA workers and was subsequently shot and later died by the New Orleans police. He was a mentally ill gentleman who was stuck in his FEMA trailer. And in my work, I see a lot of people who are really desperate and who I am really worried about that something like that could happen with. And having this deadline and having this increased stress of having to leave a trailer when they have nowhere else to go is the kind of stress that is just, devastating.
Dr. Blakely, the amount of stress, obviously this is an unprecedented kind of situation there in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, but addressing some of those issues that Lauren just spoke about, stress, for example, how do you think the city is taking that on?
Well, there are a couple things here. Neighbors are stressed, too, with the trailers there. They fear for their own safety, and we're also worried about the stress levels caused by living in the trailer. These trailers have been shown to have toxic materials in them, so it's a double bind here. We really are trying to just give people notice that they have a health condition, both because the trailer is a mobile vehicle in a storm and because the toxins in the air inside the trailer. So we're
sure. Well, Dr. Blakely, those of course would have been issues in each of the last 2 years. I would have thought during hurricane season. Then I guess my concern is in a program like this, don't you run the risk of pitting neighbor against neighbor and leaving a legacy of bitterness between homeowners and the more mobile FEMA trailer residents who are also part of the city of New Orleans?
Well, yes, there's always that tension. I have to admit that. Neighbors are concerned when there's still a trailer on the block. But we're trying to get people not out of trailers who are living in them themselves. We're trying to get people who rented the trailer out to somebody else. people who've got a relative or something who's living in the trailer who could live in the house.
So you're talking about some very complicated problems. Thank you both, Lauren Bartlett and Dr. Edward Blakely, for joining us. Lauren Bartlett is a staff attorney for the nonprofit Civil Rights Advocacy Group, the Louisiana Justice Institute, and Dr. Edward Blakely is the Executive Director for Recovery Management for the City of New Orleans. Now time for more headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the hour. The United Arab Emirates is forgiving a nearly $7 billion debt that Iraq owes to the tiny Gulf state.
I think they can afford it. Sorry, I just wanted to say that.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
Israel has reopened the border crossing into Gaza. World leaders opened the G8 summit in Japan today by focusing on Africa. And Spaniard Rafael Nadal has won his first Wimbledon title, beating five-time winner Roger Federer in a dramatic five-set match. Cholesterol tests aren't just for grown-ups anymore. The American Academy of Pediatrics will update its recommendations today to press for wider cholesterol testing in children as young as 2 years old. And the new guidelines suggest children as young as 8 may take cholesterol-fighting drugs to help prevent heart disease later on in life. In a report prepared for the G8 summit, the charity WaterAid says that 40% of the world's population still lacks access to basic sanitation facilities. Henry Norvova, of the head of WaterAid, says that this leads to diarrhea and respiratory diseases, which kill more children than malaria, HIV/AIDS, and measles combined.
It's an outrageous scandal, and it's all the more scandalous because it's entirely solvable. We have the solutions at hand. This is not a crisis that's brought about by a lack of technology, a lack of know-how.
Norvova says that improving access to sanitation is a matter of political will. And just announced this morning, Tropical Storm Bertha is now Hurricane Bertha. It's the first in the Atlantic season. No word yet on whether Bertha will reach land. It's right in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and several hundred miles east of the Caribbean. And there are about 100 new words and phrases in the latest edition of the Merriam-Webster Collegiate Dictionary. Some of the additions: dirty bomb and pescatarian, which I think has been around for a long time. Somebody who...
What's that last one?
Pescatarian.
What does that mean?
A vegetarian who...
Eats fish.
Eats fish.
Really?
Which is not a vegetarian.
I wonder if staycation...
Well, not if you're a fish, it's not a vegetarian.
Right, that's right, yeah.
What kind of vegetarian are you? Ask the fish. Eating my cod head.
Next year, staycation will be a new word.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
I like that one.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, it's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And of course, on Monday, it's traditional for political junkies all around the United States to deconstruct the nuances of the Sunday talk shows. And we want to add to the tradition and get you involved as well. So get on your email right now. Instead of just opinion and conjecture, we use hard science to calculate the actual
hard
pundit
science
word of the week. That's right. We have a complicated text analyzer that goes through all of the Sunday talk and excluding real common two-letter words like it and in. We try to find the dominant issue word. Now get ready. If you're fast and smart, you can guess the word and send it to us. We have two, one easy and then one hard bonus word before the end of this segment by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, first, listen to some excerpts from the Sunday shows with the word of the week carefully and in a sophisticated way bleeped out. I'm going to try to guess. And Adora, you play along right
here. Sounds so high tech.
There's been a significant change in Barack Obama's position on in the last week.
People want to know what his policy is on.
He used the word
position. It's a wonderful word to use.
So you think on he's coming towards John McCain?
I do.
They don't look that much different.
He has flip-flopped, if you will.
Is he a flip-flopper?
Yeah, you should wash those people's mouths out with soap, don't you think so? But no, they're not cursing. They actually said the word of the week and we bleeped it out. Now, if you paid attention to the campaign during the 4th of July week, you may recognize the issue that generated Barack Obama accusations that he is a flip-flopper.
Which should also be added to the new words in the Merriam Dictionary,
There we go, flip-flopper, exactly. Now, using the magic of editing, we made some substitutions. These are wrong. These are actually not the words. So if you guessed these unbleeps, you were wrong. Here they are. They're not the real words.
There's been a significant change in Barack Obama's position on free trade in the last week.
People want to know what his policy is on abortion.
He used the word
the Muslim.
USA. It's a wonderful word to use. USA.
So you think on Iran's nuclear facilities, he's coming towards John McCain?
I do.
They don't look that much different.
He has flip-flopped, if you will.
Is he a flip-flopper?
Which is only just how terrifyingly we could manipulate almost every piece of sound that ever gets broadcast.
I think that word is magic of editing.
Magic of editing.
Sounded so plausible.
Exactly. Well, there is a serious issue here, of course. The question for Barack Obama is he moving his positions towards the center, and is that going to be a problem with his base? So there really is a serious issue that motivated
And more
this.
So for Barack Obama than John McCain, per se, because he was already having trouble with some of the Republican base during the primaries.
They both, in trying to adjust their positions, are going to have problems all the way around. But Barack Obama was the one that was discussed last week. So do you have a guess? Huh? What is the word of the week and the bonus word? Well, we don't have a winner at this point, but we will be taking calls throughout the show. Here is the word of the week, the pundit word of the week, revealed.
One is there's been a significant change in Barack Obama's position on Iraq in the last week.
People want to know what his policy is in Iraq.
And he used the word refine.
A refining position. It's a wonderful word to use. Refining.
Yes. So you think on Iraq he's coming towards John McCain?
I do.
They don't look that much different.
He has flip-flopped, if you will.
Is he a flip-flopper?
So the word was Iraq. The bonus word was refining.
A nice word for repositioning.
For adjusting, yes, indeed. Spinning, that's sort of. So you can see all the top words on the pundit shows turned into a colorful graphic at the takeaway.org, and you can see kind of how we scientifically did this. Obama and McCain are going to be talking economics today, so it's possible the word of the week will be on quite a different subject. And, you know, this is interesting. The words think and know get used more than anything else on those pundit shows.
You're surprised.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We're talking about child obesity on the show, at least in part today, and we're talking about the importance of getting fresh produce or getting access to cholesterol screening and medication as a way of dealing with childhood obesity. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Certainly, fresh produce is an issue if you're on Mars. Food of any kind is an issue if you're on Mars. Heidi Hamel, senior research scientist at the Space Science Institute, joining us from our home in Connecticut. Heidi, our good friend in the realm of space science, what would you grow on Mars based on what the Phoenix Mars lander has discovered in the last week or so?
Well, your primary crop might be something like asparagus. Any kind of vegetables that like alkaline soil will probably thrive in the polar regions of Mars.
And what the lander has done, it's dug into the soil and baked it, and it's actually discovered at least part of the chemical composition of the soil. Can you describe how this works?
Sure. What they do is they have a little scooper, and they scoop up a piece of the soil. They dump it into a little oven. They mix it up with some water and make basically Martian mud. And then they heat that mud to a very high temperature, and then they look at the stuff that comes out of the soil when it's heated to a high temperature, and they measure it with their instrumentation, their equipment. And they find things like potassium and magnesium and chloride, and that's basically the same kind of stuff we find on the soil on Earth in alkaline soils. So while you could grow asparagus, you probably won't be growing strawberries.
And tomatoes
are acidic soil.
Tomatoes are kind of out.
Yeah.
But there's two takeaways here, if you will. One is what the soil could support today and what the chemical information tells us about what the soil has been doing over time. What's that sort of second history reveal?
Yeah, the what's been going on over time is really the most fascinating thing for us. We're seeing actually the water on Mars, and we've hoped for water on Mars for a long time and theorized about it. But what they are finding as they dig deep under the top layer of soil is they're actually seeing that water. Now, they aren't seeing so far any of the carbon-based compounds, but it's probably only a matter of time and doing a little more testing.
And carbon is, the fourth most abundant element in the universe, so it would almost be a shock if they didn't find carbon in some capacity. But I guess in terms of the search for life on Mars, it's never really mentioned how darn cold it is up there. I mean, even if they do find chemical evidence of organic compounds, I mean, nothing conceivable could actually live. What's the scenario that actually would allow life in these conditions?
Well, yeah, it's cold on the surface, but if you go down deeper into the soil, just as you go down deep into the Earth, things do get warmer, all right? So there's a possibility that they might find traces that life has existed there in the past. And also, remember, too, we're not necessarily looking for life now. We're looking for evidence that life may have existed at a time when Mars was warmer and was wetter.
What would it have taken? I mean, what would explain a warmer, wetter Mars years and years or centuries, millions and millions of years ago? How would that have occurred if it's freezing cold now?
Well, the solar system evolves with time, and the sun evolves with time as well. In the past, it was a little bit hotter, a little bit brighter. It's very, very, very slowly cooling off. So there's a very good chance, very likely chance, that Mars was warmer in the past.
And the Mars lander is working pretty well?
Yeah, it's working just fine. I mean, there's little glitches here and there. They think that one of the ovens has a short circuit, and so the next time they use, they're being very careful about using that particular oven because they're afraid that the next time they use it, it may short out again and may not work again. It has to do with the vibration of the instrument, where they have to vibrate these things to get the soil down into the oven, shake them up a little bit.
No, you see, they vibrate. No, they're kicking it, right? They're just whacking it on the side, right?
It's not exactly the same as we would whack on the side. You know, they're built to shake a little. They're built to have that capability to sort of sift the dirt through a sieve to get it down inside. But there's just a little glitch with that one particular oven. The other ovens seem to be working okay.
Heidi, can we get back to that life question?
Sure.
And I may be influenced very much by Hollywood, but the notion of what kind of life may have existed on Mars, does it necessarily have to be something that we would be aware of now?
No, well, not necessarily. So far, when we look at Mars with all the different spacecraft we've sent there, it looks like a very dead world to our eyes. So the kind of life that we're thinking about is not flowers and trees and little green creatures hopping around hiding behind rocks. It's really more microbial life, very, very small, things that you might need a microscope to see.
So the asparagus
microscope there.
The asparagus eating civilization. I should just put that right out of my mind.
I would think so. Yeah.
Now these ovens that you've described that they're vibrating the stuff into to make the Martian mud. These are single use ovens, correct? They only have a chance to cook this soil a limited number of times. How many?
Well, you know, once you've got the oven, and especially the wet ones, where you're mixing them up with mud, and you heat it up once, I mean, then your oven is like dirty, right?
Right.
Filled with Martian mud. So the next time you heat it up, you're not going to get a pristine measurement. You're going to get something that's already gone through one heating cycle. And so, yeah, it's a single-use kind of thing.
So
that's
a couple
the
of
way they're designed.
A couple of dirty ovens up there on Mars. Heidi Hamill, thanks for joining us.
Sure, it's been a pleasure.
Heidi Hamill, senior research scientist at the Space Science Institute, keeping track of what could be grown on Mars and what chance there is of life up there.
I know where there was some life yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
One word for you. Wimbledon.
Español. Nadal.
Rafael Nadal, he beat Roger Federer yesterday in a gargantuan battle. No other way to describe that. It was right down to the last second of the 4 hours, 48 minutes of play. And, John, that was the longest Wimbledon in history. Did you catch it?
Oh, yeah. It was great. It was incredible.
Christopher Clary, the New York Times reporter. Well, he joins us from the UK. How was it?
That's a pretty good word you had there, gargantuan. I like that.
It was. How else do you describe this match that just seemingly had no end?
Well, it was extraordinary, and the thing that was extraordinary about it was that it will never happen again quite that way, because it was the last year of Wimbledon without a roof, and so you'll never again see a men's final drag through all those rain delays and end in the near darkness or was it really darkness? I'm not so sure anymore, but that's really a one-off, and it was just a great way to finish an era at Wimbledon with this remarkable match, which really was one of the best finals ever played.
They went to 9:30, and let's listen to the final 30 seconds after the match.
There's a new man at the head of men's tennis. Federer's magnificent run ends. Nadal is the top man.
Christopher, is that fair to say that Federer's reign has ended?
Well, I think it's pretty easy to say that the absolute monarchy is over, I think. I think that's pretty clear. We could be heading into an oligarchy here. We'll see how it goes. But I get the feeling that we'll never see Roger dominate again like he has. And I think Nadal is only 22. He's obviously getting better. And he has just moved from being a champion only on clay in a Grand Slam to winning on grass. He's a challenge. Other players are coming up. So I don't think we're ever going to see Federer winning two or three slams a year again. But we could well see him win a Wimbledon or two if he stays motivated and comes back strong. But
it's a power-sharing arrangement as opposed to the absolute monarchy. What do you think Nadal did to improve his game to combat Federer's relentlessness as evidenced in this match, Clay or Chris?
Well, I think basically Nadal has been on a steady progress. He's had some problems with his legs and injuries, but whenever he's been healthy, he's been working really hard. He did two things this year. One, he improved his serve, which you could see he only lost his serve once yesterday in five sets, which is remarkable for a guy playing Federer on grass. And two, he's also playing closer to the baseline now, which means he's catching the ball earlier. He's harder to move off the court now, and so he's able to be more aggressive and hit through the ball.
Well, it was a great, great match, and it was just so exciting to see every bit of it. And having watched the Bjorn Borg-McEnroe match years ago in the early 80s, it was certainly a bit of history.
Yeah, I mean, people were comparing it right away to that match. McEnroe himself, who was commentating, I think, called it the best match he'd ever seen at Wimbledon.
I think it was the best match a lot of people have seen. Christopher Clary, New York Times reporter, coming to us from the UK. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Have a good day.
Take care.
I felt bad for whoever lost that game.
I know. I know.
Just went on endlessly, and they went back and forth, and there was barely any breaking of serve, and it was the Federer had won every Wimbledon since 2002.
Yeah.
That's over.
It was a historic record. Well, you can see all the top words on today's show visually represented into a single picture at thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about all kinds of things.
Childhood obesity, fresh produce to inner cities, growing vegetables on Mars, asparagus, by the way. And FEMA trailers, comment on anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also go to our website, www.thetakeaway.org.
And here is the takeaway for the day.
These days, every year, G8 leaders spend as much time thinking about poverty as they do thinking about their own rich economies.
While you're there, you can check out the new Facebook game that's from the G8 Summit, Bridget Kendall. The 2008 Veep Stakes. Go there. Buy and sell potential running mates for Barack Obama and John McCain.
It sounds like such a guilty pleasure. Buy and sell vice presidential candidates.
Yeah,
it's your one shot to do it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.